Hollywood is rated LGBT radio, starring your host, Rob Watson!
Good evening, or good day, depending on when you're listening to our show. Just a reminder that the same link that you click on to listen to us live is the link that you would use if you want to listen to this as a podcast, which means you could be listening to us with your morning coffee, and we are absolutely okay with that. Tonight, we have a really important show, lots of information that you need to know. We are in a critical juncture in the legal fight for LGBTQ rights, and depending on what happens next, could actually go into retrograde and lose ground on things that have already been accomplished. Our guest tonight will explain that even more thoroughly, and so you don't want to miss this. It is, like I said, information that you need to know. Tonight, we have my regular co-host, the esteemed journalist Brody Levesque. Also, Chris Stoll of the senior staff attorney for the National Center for Lesbian Rights will be with us. And Chris has lots of experience with legal fights in front of the Supreme Court. He has been there himself, so we can find out what that is like, what is expected on this, and what the next steps are moving forward. But first, without further ado, I'll bring on my esteemed co-host, Brody Levesque. Welcome to the show.
Hey, good evening, Rob, and good evening to our listeners. And boy, has it been a week.
What's been going on?
As expected, former Vice President Joe Biden hopped in the race today. And that kind of expands the many contenders for the Democratic ticket. And the early numbers that we're seeing polling has the vice president out ahead, but it'll be interesting to see if he can maintain that lead as we start to work our way through the primary season. A couple of other things of note. This past week, we had a young 15-year-old gay teenager in Alabama who was bullied, and he killed himself. And it's another situation, again, where we have certain elements in society saying certain things, and they're being amplified. And that amplification transmits its way down to the young people. They take it literally, and then they act on it. And unfortunately, the results of their acting on it can have devastating and, quite frankly, lethal results, as was the case with this young man. So bullying is still very, very, very much a massive problem. And it doesn't help when you get religious figures like Franklin Graham, who attacked one of the Democratic presidential candidates, Mayor Pete Buttigieg of South Bend, Indiana, in a tweet. And Graham wrote that the presidential candidate in South Bend, Mayor Pete, is right. God doesn't have a political party, but God does have commandments, laws, and standards he gives us to live by. God doesn't change. His word is the same yesterday, today, and forever. The mayor says he's a gay Christian. Well, as a Christian, I believe the Bible, which defines homosexuality as a sin, something to be repentant of, not something to be flaunted or politicized. The Bible says marriage is between a man and a woman, not two men and not two women. And, of course, this isn't really new news in terms of, you know, Graham or the others in the Christian right in terms of their messaging. But, you know, it kind of helps us to refresh folks, memories in mind that, you know, we've had a pretty tough time with these folks. And tonight's conversation with Chris is basically going to fall right within line of this, because the bottom line argument that we've heard repeatedly from the Christian right is that, you know, at the end of the day, you know, we're all sinners in the LGBTQI community. There is no such thing as trans people, on and on and on. And when you start to have conversations with them, there's absolutely no give and take and no give and take. And even though they represent an increasing minority of thought in American society, the problem is they're an extremely powerful, loud, vocal, and well-funded minority. And their viewpoints, unfortunately, translates into places that we really don't want them, to include the United States Supreme Court. Catherine Frank, who is a law professor, and she's the director of the Center for Gender and Sexuality Law, Columbia University in New York. And I've met and interviewed her. She's just phenomenal. She wrote this earlier this week, and I'm quoting Professor Frank. Not great news from the Supreme Court this morning. She wrote, it was unlikely that the court's conservative majority would find that Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, under its provisions prohibiting sex discrimination in the workplace, protects LGBT employees. Quoting the professor, our work, like in almost all other areas now, will be harm reduction. And this is what we're going to be talking to Chris about, but it kind of also expands right into these other areas. And when we have kids killing themselves still to this day, we have major religious leaders like Graham, quite frankly, just being ignorant and being hateful. And, you know, it's one of these things that, you know, I've said this on this program before. I have said this on your other show out in Santa Cruz before. But I think the time has come that we have got to stop giving them a pass when they make these statements. It's time has come that this isn't about religious freedom. This is about bigotry. This is about hate. This is about ignorance. And that their religious beliefs, quite frankly, should not have the ability to trump human and civil rights. And Rob, I, for one, I'm really just kind of tired of it. And with that, I'll throw it back to you.
Well, yeah, and because there are two things on it. One is the separation of church and state, and you know, that really needs to be respected. And I realize, you know, part of the question that will be coming up against the Supreme Court is actually going to determine whether, quite frankly, whether that will be weakened somewhat. But the other thing, just from a theological standpoint, is Franklin Graham is not God, and he doesn't speak for God, and everything he quoted is, in fact, in error of what the Bible itself actually says. So, I mean, and that really does need to be called out, and I'm really sorry there wasn't a more progressive voice speaking out and being mashed up against that and going, you're actually misquoting what is actually in the Bible for those people who choose to believe it. But even with believing it, you're wrong. One thing, Brody, I would like to do, and I think I'm going to go ahead and bring Chris on for this, but I want to hear more about the background of what these cases are that are now coming up in front of the Supreme Court, so we can get some of the backstory. Chris, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks so much for having me on.
Well, thank you for being here. Thank you for everything you do and what you have done. Chris, can you bring us up to speed on what these three cases are and how they have arrived where they have at the foot of the Supreme Court?
Sure. So these cases involve what's called Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and that's the federal law that prevents employers from discriminating based on race, sex, religion, or national origin. And these cases involve whether the prohibition on sex discrimination under Title VII includes discrimination against gay and transgender employees. So there are three cases before the court. One involves a transgender woman who was fired after she announced her intention to transition on the job while at work as well as at home in her job as a funeral director in Michigan. And when the employer found out about that, they fired her because they did not approve of transgender people. And the other two cases involve gay men who were fired when their employers learned that they were gay. And so the issue in these cases is whether the federal prohibition on sex discrimination includes prohibiting an employer from firing an employee for being transgender or for being gay, because those forms of discrimination are a form of sex discrimination. And as I say, in recent years, the federal courts have increasingly, over the past couple of decades, pretty consistently recognized that you can't fire someone for being transgender or fire someone for being gay without taking their sex into account. And that's illegal under federal law. And so now the Supreme Court has decided to review those questions, that question, and establish a precedent on that that would apply to courts throughout the nation.
So great explanation. Thank you for that. That was really clear and wonderful. The experts we seem to be hearing from, especially the ones who are the LGBT legal advocates, all seem to be fairly nervous and not too positive about this landing in front of the current court. Is that warranted, or what is your outlook on this?
Well, you know, there's no question that with the new administration and the appointment of two new justices, the court has moved in a more conservative direction. And what I'll say about that, though, is in these cases, if those conservative justices, Justices Gorsuch and Kavanaugh, are being really true to their conservative principles, we should win these cases. Now, I'm saying that as an advocate, not as a predictor. But if these justices are being true to their position that statutes passed by Congress should be interpreted according to their strict text, then it's hard to see how we could lose these cases, because it's rather obvious that if you are firing a man because he likes to date men when you would not fire a woman who likes to date men, that's a form of sex discrimination. If you are firing a transgender person because they don't comport with your notions of what a man or a woman should look like or act like or sound like, that's sex discrimination. And so if these justices are applying this text according to the literal meaning of its words, they should rule in our favor. I'm not saying they should.
We won't hold you to this. Even though this is recorded, we won't be playing it back and go, you know, what happened here? No, but Chris, watching the behavior so far, and watching Justice Roberts so far, and Kavanaugh has, I think, surprised people on some of the rulings that he's come out with, surprised them in that he was more bipartisan, less strict conservative than they expected. Are we going to see some advocacy on the part of those two justices, do you think?
You know, I think, as I say, all of the justices, if they're following a consistent, you know, pattern of principle according to the way they believe in interpreting statutes, and Roberts is right there with them, they really have no problem seeing the obvious connection between a person's sexual orientation and their sex, or a person's transgender status and their sex. I think that we're going to be trying to persuade every single one of the justices. And, and of course, Justice Roberts had sometimes, shown some flexibility, some willingness to, you know, break out of sort of the lockstep conservative mold, particularly when the court's reputation is at stake. And I think this is a case where the court's reputation is at stake. You know,
right.
it would be really shocking, honestly, really shocking, if the court kind of stepped out and said that legal protections that the federal courts, the lower federal courts all around the country have been increasingly agreeing apply to gay and transgender people, if they would just shut that down and say that doesn't apply and they would take that away. That's not something that the court has done very often, and I think people will be really quite surprised and possibly quite outraged if the court does that.
One of the things, Chris, and I'm just going to interject here, and I know that a lot of the listeners kind of get a little confusing on this. Would you mind explaining the legal definition of protected classes, enumerated rights, and how these could apply to Title VII? Because I've heard that argument raised by some attorneys to the right, shall we say, of the spectrum. And I know that Justice Gorsuch has long been a literalist in terms of, you know, the specifics, and also in terms of deciding what is or is not in terms of the intent of Congress when they write these laws. So there's kind of two parts to that.
Sure. So, well, in terms of the protected classes, that's something that in this case, it's not defined in the Constitution, but this case concerns Title VII, which is a law that was passed by Congress in 1964. It's the famous Civil Rights Act of 1964 that, you know, first prohibited discrimination based on race, and also just prohibits discrimination based on sex and religion in employment. And so the question is whether, you know, discriminating against a gay person because they're gay and therefore don't sort of fit an employer's stereotypical notions of what a person of a particular sex should be like or should be doing, whether that constitutes sex discrimination under Title VII, and the same for transgender people. Does that failure to kind of comport with stereotypical notions of sex constitute sex discrimination under Title VII? And the federal courts, the lower federal courts over the past decade or two, have pretty unanimously answered that question, yes. And that dates back to a case in the 1980s. The basis for that dates back primarily to a case in the 1980s in which the Supreme Court recognized that sex discrimination doesn't just mean firing a woman because she's a woman. It also means taking sex into account in a way that results in adverse treatment based on that illegitimate sex-based consideration. So in the case in the 1980s, it involved a woman who was wanted to be a partner, was an accountant who wanted to be a partner at the accounting firm of Price Waterhouse. And she was denied that partnership because she was perceived as being, quote, you know, too aggressive or too masculine for the employer's concept of what a woman partner should act like. And the court said, no, that's sex discrimination. That it's not just discriminating against all women because they're women. It also includes discriminating against women because they don't comport with the employer's conception of what a woman should be like. And so since that case came down, the federal courts increasingly have said, well, if that's true, if you can't fire a woman for being too masculine, it's got to also be true that you can't fire a person for being transgender because they don't fit your notion of what a man or a woman should look like or act like or be like. And it's a pretty direct comparison there. So that's sort of the way in which courts have come to recognize gay and transgender people as being covered by Title VII. Now, in terms of Congress's, you know, what did Congress intend in 1964 when it passed the statute? That's an argument that we hear a lot on the other side. Is it's, you know, it's absurd to think that in 1964 these congressmen believed that they were protecting gay and transgender people from discrimination. Well, the Supreme Court has actually also spoken about that before, and that was in a 1998 case, which was actually written by Justice Scalia, one of the most conservative justices on the court, and it concerned the question of whether under Title VII sexual harassment on the job by a male supervisor of a male employee, same-sex sexual harassment, could violate Title VII. And they said the answer, Justice Scalia said the answer is yes. And that is because the statute talks about sex discrimination. This is a form of sexual harassment. And the fact that the court in 1964 may not have even been, that the Congress in 1964 may not have had in mind, may not have even been thinking in a million years of the idea that there might one day be, you know, a claim involving a male-on-male sexual harassment, doesn't matter. All that matters is the words of the law, and that law prohibits sex discrimination, and this is a form of that.
I remember the case that I was trying to figure out, you know, because a lot of times people ask me that question, and in, of course, in the first case that you were referring to, Price Waterhouse versus Hopkins, Scalia, Rehnquist, and Kennedy had been the dissent in that case, and then probably 10 years later, Scalia turned around and upheld the other one. So I always found that kind of an interesting dynamic between the two of them. So thanks, Chris.
Yeah. Chris, Anthony Kennedy in Colorado, I believe it was one of the first cases where, I mean, it was a question of discrimination against gay people, and he ruled essentially making LGBT people a protected class, which Brody was just referring to. And is there any significance that he is kind of the mentor of Kavanaugh, and will they respect that action that he wrote about in that particular case?
Well, you know, that is one of the big unanswered questions here. We really don't know very much at the end of the day about what Kavanaugh thinks about these issues. He doesn't have a whole lot of a track record about it. So, you know, one hopes that he is open to hearing these arguments and giving them fair consideration. And as I say, we are very hopeful that if these justices are being true to their conservative principles, like Justice Scalia was in the sexual harassment case, that they will, you know, they will be open to hearing our arguments.
So, playing negative Nelly on this, what is, and I appreciate your perspective on it, because it does sound positive and hopeful of what the outcome should be. But if it were to go the other way, number one, what do you see the justification the current court might use to send it the other way? And more importantly, what do you see the long-term effects of it being ruled in that direction?
Well, you know, as I say, it would be a very shocking thing for the court to do that, because they would actually be taking away, you know, protections that the lower courts have pretty unanimously agreed are there. And, you know, you don't see the court doing that very often. And so I think people will be pretty shocked if they do that. If they do go in the wrong direction, I think it might very well be along the lines of what we just discussed, that they don't think that protecting gay people and transgender people was anything that the Congress had in mind in enacting the Civil Rights Act, and that you know, that they think we should go to Congress to have that law passed explicitly if those are the protections that people want to have. And I actually think that, you know, that would be a really strong catalyst toward getting those protections passed. You know, the Equality Act, which is the law that would add express protections or recognize these existing protections for gay and transgender people under federal law, has been introduced, you know, several times. And I think a bad decision in this case might very well be an impetus to move that statute forward and possibly get these measures through Congress, you know, as an explicit federal law.
That's interesting you should say that, because I had a conversation with Drew Hamill, who is the spokesperson for House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. And here's what Hamill said, not only just to me, but also to my colleague Chris Johnson at the Washington Blade. And I'll just paraphrase what he told Chris. Quote, "I would just make the point that House passage sends a strong message to SCOTUS," Hamill said. And he was talking about the Equality Act as it has been introduced by Representative David Cicilline of Rhode Island and Senator Jeff Merkley of Oregon. The other thing, and this is what I wanted to touch upon with you real quick, Chris, besides expanding and updating federal law to include sex in the protected classes for public accommodation, expanding definition of public accommodations to include retail operations, banks, transportation services, healthcare, the act would also establish that the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, okay, which is aimed at protecting quote-unquote religious liberty, can't be used to enable anti-LGBT discrimination. So here's my question. The Religious Freedom Restoration Act has been used by the right, particularly the folks at Alliance Defending Freedom, the Thomas More Law Center, and Liberty Council, among others, in addition to your family values groups, as kind of a sledgehammer, if you will, bludgeoning the community, the LGBTQ community, with it. You're an attorney. You make your arguments. You're a litigator. How much of an impact and an impediment is this going to be, since the Equality Act isn't on the books yet, in terms of the argument that the right's constantly using with the Religious Freedom Restoration Act?
Sure. So a couple of things about the Equality Act. You know, even if we get a good decision in these cases, it'll still be very, very important to pass the Equality Act for one of the reasons that you just mentioned. Federal law does not currently prevent discrimination in what's called public accommodations based on sex. It only prohibits that based on race and religion. And what that means is public accommodations means that certain types of businesses, you know, including hotels and restaurants, and the Equality Act would expand that to include other types of private businesses. They are prohibited from discriminating not just against their employees, but also against their customers. Right now, there's no federal protection that prevents a business from discriminating based on sex against their customers. So that's one important reason why we need the Equality Act, regardless of how this case comes out. In terms of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, there's a sort of a issue that's been kind of percolating through the courts for many years about whether that law, which is a law that was passed by Congress in the 1990s, that prohibits the government from imposing, you know, certain kinds of burdens on religious belief and practice unless the government can show its the least restrictive way to accomplish some very important, you know, governmental interest, and provides a defense against certain kinds of federal agency actions against people based on their religious beliefs. There's a debate that's sort of been bubbling through the courts about whether that law applies in cases brought by private parties against other private parties under federal law, such as a claim for employment discrimination under Title VII. Many courts have held that it does not actually even apply in those circumstances, but the Supreme Court has not yet addressed that. And so what that would do is it would make that rule that says that many courts, again, have already recognized, that says RFRA just does not apply in a Title VII case or discrimination case, and just make that explicit. And again, it's really important that be done, because some courts have reached a different conclusion about that. And what that means is that every time you know, a religious employer fires an LGBT employee, there's always potentially an issue that they're going to raise that, that basically RFRA prevents any type of, you know, remedy for that discrimination.
So Chris, and I appreciate your insight on all of this, and I don't want to make this sound like I'm digging down towards the negative, but let's say Congress doesn't pass the Equality Act, the Supreme Court does rule, you know, that you know these do not count under the title. What then is the end ramifications of this case going south? No remedy from Congress, especially with a split Congress and a hostile president. What happens across the country where people have enjoyed protection up to now?
Well, you know, it'll be, you know, a very bad development for people, particularly in more conservative states, because right now we have 21 states that have some form of state law that expressly protects gay and transgender people against discrimination, and some cities and counties, you know, outside those 21 states as well. But that, you know, there are a majority of states that don't have any state law protections based on sexual orientation or gender identity. And so a bad decision from the Supreme Court and no Equality Act would mean that, you know, people in over half the states would not have any statutory protection against being fired or, you know, being denied a promotion because they're gay or transgender. And that would really be an unfortunate development. And it would also be really go ahead.
No, but they don't have that now either, correct?
They don't have protection under state locations. law, but under the federal cases that are now being appealed to the Supreme Court, they do have those protections under federal law. And that's a very important thing for people in states like Indiana where there's no, you know, there's no state protection of any kind, but they do have the force of, you know, a decision from the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals that says Title VII protects you from being fired for being gay or transgender, and that applies even in those states that don't have any state law protections right now, and the question now before the Supreme Court is whether they're going to take that away.
Right. And what about things like the marriage decisions? How would this affect those at all in retrograde?
No, it'll have no effect at all on the marriage decision because that's a decision that was under the federal constitution. People have a constitutional right under the Equal Protection Clause and the Due Process Clause of the Constitution to marry a same-sex partner, and that will not change unless the Supreme Court were to decide a future case that changed that.
Chris, let me ask you that for just a second. And again, I don't want to be completely negative about this, but you know, when you look at the court and the makeup, again, you're a litigator. The arguments that are probably the most important to present to those justices as this is being argued, what would you pick out as a litigator and as someone who would make the oral arguments? Let's say it was going to be you making the oral arguments. What would be the highlight, the high points, the kind of the gotcha hooks, legal gotcha hooks to make the justices see, you know, the dramatic human impact of this?
Well, you know, I think it's pretty easy to tell a story about, you know, how devastating it can be for a person to lose their job, to lose their only source of income, not based on how they perform at work, not based on how well they do their job or anything like that, just based on the fact that they're gay or they're transgender, just based on who they are. And I think any any person who looks at that story, that situation, and it happens all the time, all across the country. We get calls every week about things like this. To see how unfair that is, and how devastating it is for people, and how it devastates their families, and prevents them from having stability in their lives. I think it's a pretty easy picture to paint, and it's why opinion polls pretty consistently show that an overwhelming majority of the American people believe it should be illegal to fire someone for being gay or for being transgender. And that's a story that, the justices decide things based on the law, but they don't live in a vacuum. I think they need to hear those stories as much as possible between now and probably November, when this case will be argued.
Right. Chris, I'm going to switch a little bit to more of a personal note. You personally have been in front of the Supreme Court and worked on the cases and everything else. Can you give us a little insight as to what that feels like, just both professionally and personally, to be in that environment and the pressure that somebody in your profession feels in that venue?
Sure. Well, there's probably nothing more overwhelming or difficult that you could experience as a litigator. I've never actually argued a case before the court, but I have helped people get ready for arguments before the court, and I've been in the room while they're arguing it. And it is quite a spectacle. It's basically standing there for half an hour or more and getting constantly peppered with questions by nine different, very intelligent people, many of whom already have an opinion about the case or are trying to kind of make points that their colleagues, so that their colleagues can hear them. And to stay on your feet and answer those questions in an intelligent way and in a way that, will enhance your client's position is one of the hardest things in the world to do. And that's why there's a very small group of people who are expert at doing it, and it's one of the toughest jobs you can have as a lawyer. I've also been in the room when a decision's announced, and in fact I was there for the marriage equality decision. And let me tell you, you can cut the tension in the room with a knife when you're there waiting for the outcome of a case that is going to be very, very close. And then the Chief Justice comes out and announces who wrote the opinion, and that justice, usually reads a portion of the opinion, and in the case of the marriage cases, that was Justice Kennedy, I was kind of holding my breath from the time they got on the bench until the time the Chief Justice announced that Justice Kennedy was going to read the opinion, and I said, okay, this is going to be okay. Kind of exhaled at that moment, and that's kind of what it's like. It's a very it's a very formal kind of grandiose experience, and I really recommend that anybody who can do it go to Washington and sit in the audience at an oral argument sometime. It's a pretty amazing experience.
I've done it myself, and I will second that. For some of our listeners who don't know, Chris is an attorney for the National Center for Lesbian Rights, which is headquartered in San Francisco, California. NCLR is a national legal organization. It's committed to advancing the civil and human rights of the LGBTQI community, their families, through litigation, legislative policy, and public education. NCLR is a nonprofit, and it's a public interest law firm. On a personal note, I have been associated as a journalist with NCLR for well over 12 years now, and I think the world of these people. And because they are a nonprofit, 75% of their annual budget comes from individual donors, I would highly, highly, highly advocate that you folks look them up on the web at www.nclrrights.org and stroke them a check or give them a credit card or a PayPal or whatever to keep Chris and our dear friend Shannon Minter, the legal director, and everybody else busy and defending our rights. Now that I've done with your little PR stick, I have a question for you.
Sure.
What's going to be the toughest part, do you think, going into this? Keeping in mind that there's going to be amicus briefs burying the court. So what do you think will be probably the most difficult part of this as a lawyer?
Oh, gosh. First of all, thanks so much for saying those nice things about NCLR. You know, we're really under assault from this new administration, and we're kind of fighting the good fight on multiple fronts. And I really appreciate your saying such nice things about us. You know, the hardest thing, as far as the employment cases go, the hardest thing I think is going to be making sure that the arguments are presented in a way that that will appeal to those same five conservative justices that we've been talking about. You know, I think that there's a certain way of making arguments that they like to see, and they like to know that what they're doing is well grounded in the text, you know, well grounded in the intent of the statute. And I think we have really good things to say about those things here, as I've mentioned before. And the trick here is just sort of giving the court a clear path to understand why this is the obvious and the correct result. Because, you know, even these conservative justices will reach the right result if you show them the way to get there. It may not be their inclination. It may or may not be what they thought the case was going to be when they went into it. But you know, I found in previous cases that sometimes, you know, even when the court grants a review of a case thinking it's going to do one thing, there are ways you can structure the argument that kind of changes their mind a little bit. And, you know, one example of that would be a few years back, we worked on a case involving the Christian Legal Society chapter at the Hastings Law School here in San Francisco that had a policy of excluding or requiring its members to sign a statement of faith that basically excluded people who were, quote, unrepentant homosexuals from being members. And, you know, when the court granted review of that case, we were very, you know, scared that the court was going to say that Hastings had to provide funding to that group, not despite having that discriminatory admission policy. But we were able to show the court that Hastings applied that policy in such a way that they were not favoring or disfavoring particular student groups, and in fact that the record in the lower courts demonstrated that, and that the plaintiffs, the CLS students in the case, had agreed that that was how Hastings applied their policy. And when the justices saw that, we were able to persuade Justice Kennedy, who, you know, wouldn't necessarily have been on our side in that case at the outset, to join the so-called liberal justices in ruling in Hastings' favor in that case. And so, you know, what we found is that, you know, if you hit on the right type of argument, the right note, you can bring along a justice or two who may not have been with you at the outset.
I remember the Hastings case.
Justices like Thomas and Alito, is there an argument for either one of them that you would try to reach them, or are they lost causes?
Oh, I think it's a little hard to say. I mean, I think, you know, they could be persuaded with a similar type of plain text argument. We're certainly going to be trying to do that. You know, it's a little hard to predict Justice Thomas because he hasn't, you know, I don't think he's demonstrated a clear pattern of kind of breaking out of the mold, like, you know, in that way. But I think, you know, Justice Alito certainly could potentially be appealed to with that kind of an argument as well.
Chris, let's talk a little bit about the process for some of our listeners. I just used a term that Rob and I and you are familiar with, but some members of the public aren't. The term is amicus brief. Could you explain briefly what an amicus brief is and how it is transmitted to the court and why, in this case in particular, it's going to be so important?
Sure, sure. So in any important case like this, and you know, I have no doubt that these cases are going to be probably two of the biggest cases next term, the court typically gets, you know, sometimes even several dozen amicus briefs on either side of the case. And what an amicus brief is, it's a brief that's submitted by a party that's not before the court, but has an interest in the outcome of the decision. So, you know, if a case involves a particular law that regulates a particular industry, you might have groups from that industry filing amicus briefs on either side, even though they're not the ones directly before the court. And the purpose of those briefs is to give the court, you know, information that will be helpful to its decision that might not necessarily be in the party's briefs or be discussed very fully in the party's briefs, but it's important to get before the court. And so, you know, in these cases, you know, we expect that we'll have briefs from a whole range of groups, you know, women's rights groups, because the way the court decides these cases could very well have an impact, not just on LGBT people, but on the way sex discrimination is interpreted to apply to women in the workplace generally. It could be a very devastating case for women in the workplace, depending on how they decide to, you know, interpret these past cases like the Anne Hopkins case about sex discrimination in the workplace. You know, we expect that there will be a brief from business groups, a lot of the big companies around the nation who will talk about how important it is to have workers who are happy and healthy in their workplaces, and that discriminating against LGBT workers is bad for business. You know, there'll just be a range of voices like this. There may be religious voices. There may be, you know, medical voices talking about what it means to be transgender. All of these sorts of things are given to the court so that they have a full basis, full range of information to make their decision. And they can be really, really important. They can raise things that might, you know, turn on a light bulb in one justice's head that the parties just don't have time to talk about or space to cover. So they're very, very important for any Supreme Court case, and especially a really, really important one like this.
So, Chris, I want to go the other direction from what we've been asking before, because I think we've been a little bit wanting to cover the bases in case things went badly and everything else. Should the court rule, as you've sort of implied that they very well might, really solidifying these protections, what would the impact be right away on things like the transgender ban in the military, some of Betsy DeVos's intended policies in education? How fast would that positive ripple be felt?
Sure. Well, you know, a positive decision here would be a tremendous thing. It would send a very, very clear signal that the court is going to stand on principle, that it's going to interpret statutes fairly, and that it's, you know, not going to rule against LGBT people in some sort of knee-jerk fashion. And that, I think, you know, may have reverberations throughout the rest of the government. You know, we've seen for the first time, really, from the Trump administration, we've seen a sort of an unprecedented effort to roll back protections that were already in place before the new administration took office. And this is really, you know, the first time that we've seen that. We've seen Betsy DeVos basically say that the Department of Education is not going to protect transgender students from discrimination. We've seen the Trump administration reimpose a ban on service by transgender service members when they had already been, you know, granted the right to serve openly. And we've seen this kind of rollback over and over and over again from the Trump administration. We're probably about to see the Department of Health and Human Services revoke its rule that was passed under the Affordable Care Act that basically said you can't discriminate against healthcare providers can't discriminate and insurers can't discriminate against transgender people when providing healthcare. That's probably going to be rolled back. And so a clear signal from the Supreme Court that that sort of thing is not going to stand, I think, and hope, would give the administration, you know, pause in doing that sort of thing. Now, it wouldn't directly impact any of those things because it really will, the ruling itself will, you know, will only address Title VII. It won't address anything beyond that, such as the military ban. Those are separate cases. But it really will send a very important and positive signal about this court and about what it's going to do in future cases.
Speaking of sending signals, I was curious to see where you were going to go.
Well, good. I'm glad I intrigued you. But speaking of sending signals, what signals do you think the Trump administration are going to send to the court in their both the amicus briefs and other ways? And obviously, they're going to pull against a positive ruling on this.
Sure. Yeah, we have a very strange situation in this case because the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which is the agency that was created by the Civil Rights Act of 1964 to be the government agency that's in charge of enforcing federal employment protection laws, has for many years had express rulings that their official position is that Title VII, sex discrimination provisions of Title VII prevent employers from discriminating against employees based on their sexual orientation or gender identity. So right now you can file a complaint with your EEOC office if you're facing employment discrimination based on your sexual orientation or gender identity, and they will investigate that complaint. And if they find that discrimination has occurred, they will issue a finding of discrimination. And they actually appeared in one of the cases and argued, actually maybe both of the cases, and argued in favor of the position that Title VII protects gay and transgender workers from discrimination. Well, when the new administration came in, the Justice Department also came in and was arguing the case on the other side. So you had government attorneys arguing these cases on both sides. And we expect that will also happen in the Supreme Court because the EEOC is a party to those cases and has not changed its position. So it's a very odd situation where the government kind of doesn't know what its position is. And the Justice Department is actually arguing against one of its own agencies, which is a pretty unique thing. And it's another powerful reason why the Supreme Court really should take a big pause before it issues any sort of ruling against the transgender and gay workers in these cases.
Rob actually went down the path I was going to go, so I'm going to switch gears. That's why I was curious to see where you were going to go with this, Rob, because I had a feeling that's where you were going to go, so you did. So, as they say, asked and answered. Chris, but there is something that I'd like to ask you real quick. We often talk about in terms of significance when it comes down to Supreme Court rulings because they become entered in as case law, which then becomes routinely cited in federal cases all over the place. Some cases are more important than others. In this particular case, would you elevate the importance of these three cases together into the same grouping of social impact, say, as Loving v. Virginia, Roe v. Wade, Obergefell v. Windsor v. U.S.? I mean, do these reach that threshold?
I would say that they're right up there. I mean, it's somewhat different because these cases involve a federal statute rather than the U.S. Constitution, and Congress can always change a federal statute. They can't change the Constitution. But in terms of the impact on the lives of LGBT people, this is as significant as marriage equality or as Bowers versus Hardwick, which was the case that originally upheld sodomy laws in the states, and then Lawrence versus Texas, which changed that and made sodomy laws unconstitutional. It's right up there with any of those because it really concerns an issue that's so close and to and impacts so many LGBT people around the country. And what's interesting is that the timing of this case is such that, you know, it's going to be argued in the fall and probably, you know, decided either in the spring or summer of 2020. So you could very well have this decision coming down smack in the middle of the presidential primary or right as the general election campaign is beginning. And I fully expect that if there is a negative decision in this case holding that Title VII doesn't protect gay and transgender workers, that this is going to be a major issue in the presidential election. And President Trump is going to have to explain why he believes that gay and lesbian and transgender workers should not be protected against discrimination in employment, why they should be able to be fired for being gay or transgender, and why his Justice Department advocated that position. And he's going to have to explain whether he will sign the Equality Act if it's passed through Congress. And the Democratic candidate's going to have to answer the same thing. And I think it's potentially going to be a very, very important issue in the presidential campaign, kind of regardless of how it comes out, but especially if it's a bad decision.
Sounds good.
Chris, yeah, we're actually down to our last few minutes here. What question haven't we asked about this that we should have?
I can't think of anything. We've kind of covered the waterfront. I just can't overemphasize how important these cases are for our community and how important it is that that the court really hear the stories of people who are facing this type of discrimination. And I think it would be a wonderful thing if, you folks in the journalistic field and people who are experiencing these kinds of terrible situations at work really spoke up, and we really heard a lot from people about, why these protections are important and how devastating it is to, lose your job just because of, who you are or who you love.
Right.
Well,
Chris, I want to thank you so much for being on. And again, this is if this goes positively, hopefully I'll right the wrong that you can get married in half the states of the country and then get fired the next day for doing it. It's very, very important. Chris, thank you again for showing up here tonight, for your explanation, for your insight, for the work you do. Everything at the National Center for Lesbian Rights. We salute you and appreciate you so very much. Brody, as always, your insight, brilliance, thank you for being on board here. I want to thank our listeners for tuning in. Also, don't forget to listen on Saturday nights, 7 p.m. Pacific Time, 10 p.m. Eastern Time, to www.ksco.com. And that would be Out in Santa Cruz with more LGBTQ stories and points of interest. And as for us at Rated LGBT Radio, we'll be back here next week, same time, same place, with something equally as fascinating. And we can't wait to see you then.
You've been listening to Rated LGBT Radio.